Welcome to this episode of My Journey as a Physicist. On this episode, we are joined by Christopher Aubin, an associate professor of physics at Fordham University. He specializes in high-energy physics. I hope you enjoy listening to his journey as a physicist. Well, welcome, Professor Christopher Aubin. Could you briefly introduce yourself? You know, what is your position and role?
Oh, yes. Thank you for having me. So, I'm Professor Christopher Aubin. I'm an associate professor here at Fordham University, and I'm the director of the 3-2 cooperative engineering program that we have with Columbia. And I've been at Fordham for about 11 years now. Before that, I was a postdoc at the College of William and Mary for 3 years. And before that, going back in time, I was a postdoc at Columbia University for 3 years. And just before that was when I got my PhD in high energy physics at Washington University in St. Louis.
Okay. Can you describe a little bit about the research or work that you do?
Yeah. So I'm in the field of what we call lattice gauge theory, which is really just a fancy way of saying particle physics on a computer. So we take, generally speaking, it's the theory of the strong interactions, the interactions that hold quarks and gluons together to form protons and neutrons. And this is a theory that can't be solved analytically at all, not exactly. And so we take space and time and we discretize it on a space-time lattice. And in doing so, we can basically simulate the interactions between quarks and gluons numerically. And so these are simulations that are run on extremely large supercomputers and computer clusters in around the world. A lot of what I do more specifically is related to systematic errors that arise when you do these sorts of simulations. So trying to figure out not only what certain physical quantities are, but how trustworthy are those numbers once we've finished doing the simulation.
Okay. Yeah. That was going to be like my kind of like next question was like, okay, you do these simulations and, but obviously like there must be some sort of experiment, something you compare to, like, what does that kind of, you know, interaction or collaboration kind of look like, you know, if you're doing more theory versus, you know, experimental?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. A lot of times people think that theory and experiment are completely separated, right? And the theorists are off just making things up, trying to play around with some math. But in, especially in our field, there's a lot of collaboration among the two. And so in some cases, for example, one of the projects I work on is calculating the theoretical calculation of the muon G-2, or the basically the magnetic moment of the muon. And the muon is a heavy copy of the electron, or heavy cousin of the electron. And we're looking at the QCD contributions to its magnetic moment. And this is a perfect example where theory and experiment are run completely separately in some ways, in that the experimental run at Fermilab just finished the first pass just a couple months ago. Well, they announced the results a couple months ago. And meanwhile, all the while, the theory side is doing the calculation and we're comparing the two. And because of, you know, obviously it's known that in experimental work, there are error bars, there are uncertainties in the final results that you get out. The same is true for the theory side. There are uncertainties in our results. And so that's where a lot of the interesting interplay comes into play, because you're trying to compare two numbers, both with error bars, and see how well they work. There are other calculations that I've been involved in and that we work on in my field, which are more connected with experimental work, in that there are often, you know, there's the kaon mixing parameter is a good example. There are cases where we have an expression for a number, say a physical quantity, like the kaon mixing parameter. And this is where a kaon can turn into a different kind of kaon. And there's sort of this number, which is experimentally measurable, which equals something that can only be calculated with lattice QCD in the strong interactions times some known expression, but that known expression has some unknowns in it. And so you don't just do the theory calculation and do the experimental calculation, but you have to combine them to sort of make constraints on other unknown numbers that appear in the standard model of particle physics. So yeah, there's generally quite a bit of interplay between the two.
Do you have a research team group that you are a part of, that there's you or maybe like grad students or other faculty members? And if so, like how big is that?
Yeah, so it can vary. A lot of theoretical work is done in much smaller groups, but of course, with these sorts of calculations, we often need much larger collaborations. And I've been part of, in the past, collaborations as many as 20 or 30 people. And this is faculty, postdocs, and graduate students. Nowadays, my main project that I've been working on, this muon G-2 project, the actual project, or my work, is with a fairly small collaboration of three other faculty members. And every so often, a graduate student of theirs will join. Here at Fordham, we don't have any graduate students. So a lot of the other work that I tend to do, which is with research with undergraduates here at Fordham, tend to be little side projects that are more for involving students in research, or perhaps introducing them to the ways of lattice QCD. In that case, for example, that's something that I work on more by myself with my undergraduates. And one of the big things I've been doing right now, and this has involved three different students so far, is just creating a small Python suite of lattice code that basically the students have worked on entirely by themselves, with, of course, my help. And the idea there is to just get undergraduates more involved in what's a very, very advanced topic and usually never discussed when someone's an undergraduate. So
when you were an undergrad, so you said you did like high energy physics when you're in grad school. When did you know that like you wanted to go into physics?
Well, that's a good one. Back when I was in high school, I was always very good at math, and I took physics and I realized that I liked it. But I was always more interested in math, and until I went to college, and it was freshman year that I was taking physics and calculus and realized that I wasn't as interested in the mathematics unless it had some sort of meaning behind it. So I switched over to physics as a freshman in college. And at that point, I was really just taking classes because I thought they were fun, right? I just loved physics. It was fun to do. And the summer after my junior year, I did an REU program at the University of Oklahoma. And now the research I did there, it was theoretical work. I did not like it specifically. It was atomic physics that it was okay, but it wasn't really my thing. I always found gravity and particle physics more interesting when I was an undergrad. But I realized that I actually enjoyed the process of research. And so that's what sort of prompted me to go to graduate school, because I figured, well, you get paid to do more physics. So it's sort of a win-win. And I didn't really know a lot about particle physics, except that I thought it was interesting, right? I never took a particle physics class really as an undergrad. But when I went to grad school, I talked to the high energy group at WashU and the gravity group, and I just found that what they were doing seemed interesting. So I just sort of jumped in on it. And then sort of, as they say, the rest is history.
Very interesting. What was like your process in, you know, applying for, say, like grad school, or like when you're a physics, like did you know like, oh, I want to be a researcher or maybe go into industry? Like, did you have these sorts of thoughts?
I really didn't. I was sort of just sort of saying, oh, well, let me apply to graduate schools because I don't want to apply for a real job. And in there, I was sort of choosing graduate schools that had basically had groups in what I just said, gravity and high energy theory. I knew I wanted to be a theorist. I did know that I did not want to go into industry. That I could pretty much say, because I always liked teaching. I mean, I remember even way back when I was in second and third grade. I always loved the idea of teaching, and all throughout my childhood, I was sort of that kid that helped helped other kids by essentially tutoring them. So that was sort of always in my mind, the idea of going into academia. And while I was in grad school, I actually started to love research. I did really get into it. And so for a while, I was really on a, I don't really care where I go as long as I get to do research. While I was a postdoc, however, I found research can be exceptionally isolating. And when you're a graduate student, it's not as bad because, well, you're a grad student, you have all these friends that are around. And when you're a postdoc, you're a little bit more separated. You're not with the graduate students, and you're not really with the faculty. It's sort of its own beast. And research is such a long scale process, right? It takes months, months, years to get anything accomplished. And while that's fun, I missed, while I was a postdoc, actually, the interactions with human beings, which we also are missing nowadays. But anyway, that's besides the point. And so I knew actually during my second postdoc that while I would basically apply to any faculty jobs, I avoided any lab positions actually that went out there. And I applied to a lot of schools that were much more teaching oriented, where the teaching load would be much, much higher, until I ended up here at Fordham, where we have sort of a higher than normal teaching load for, say, an R1 university. We have sort of a 2-2 load, but it's not as high as a liberal arts college where you might be teaching three classes every semester. And so this is sort of that perfect middle ground for me that, I'd always thought that if I hadn't sort of made it to this point in academia, I would have probably just gone and taught high school physics, because for me, doing the teaching side of things was much more of an important thing to do than doing the research side of things.
So, like in your job now, what does like a typical day look like? Like you have research, you have teaching, you have, I'm sure other commitments too in the department. What does kind of like an average day look like?
Yeah, so it depends on the day of the week, of course. So I sort of think of it as there are sort of three kinds of days that I have every week. We're lucky enough that we're able to get our teaching. We have a lot of input on how we can organize our teaching. So I generally make sure that I'm always teaching the same, both my classes the same days of the week. And so that'll either be 2 days a week or 3 days a week of actual teaching commitments. And those days, it's almost entirely just teaching. It's preparation for class, teaching a class, obviously, and usually any additional time around that is doing little administrative tasks or side things. Basically, those are sort of non-research days. Then there are the day the, on the days that I'm not teaching. Usually, I set aside 1 day every week where I don't respond to any emails from students. I don't respond to anything that's teaching or service based. I only respond to research based things. So I try to have 1 day every week that is just me on my computer. And those are days that I tend to, okay, non-COVID times would be home. And that way, if I'm out of sight, out of mind, if I'm not on campus, then it's a lot easier for people to not possibly contact me. And then there are the non-teaching days where it's sort of a free for all. I'll tend to be on campus. Students will come by, and I'll often meet with them, especially research students or office hours for classes. And all the while, of course, there's the service side of things with university committees, which those sort of get peppered in throughout the week, every week. It doesn't take up a ton of time, really, it seems, or it doesn't, at least on paper, it doesn't. It feels like I only do that sometimes, but what I like about being at a university is that there's not really the average day. Every day is sort of its own special beast. And I have a lot of freedom with at least the times that I can schedule for things.
Okay. Do you have like a strong preference for like a specific aspect of like the teaching or the research, or do you just kind of like that it's always a little bit different and so that you don't have to be stuck to one thing?
Yeah, it's I like it to be a little bit different all the time. You know, there's when I was a postdoc and doing mostly just research, obviously, I liked having multiple projects because when I got to a point where something just made no sense and I had no clue what was going on, I could just put it aside and work on something else. And that's sort of the way I like it here, that, you know, sometimes I'll be working on something research wise and it will, you know, actually what I'm doing today is doing these calculations in Mathematica that take 20 or 30 minutes each run, and I can't do anything about that and or about fixing it or changing it or the next step until one run is finished. It's not long enough where you can just leave it and do something else more productive. So in these kinds of days, I set it up. So I'm like, okay, well, while that's running, while this research is going, I'll prepare my class for tomorrow because I'm teaching a summer class this session. I like the idea of being able to say, okay, well, I can't work on this now because it's not making sense to me, or, you know, even as much as we love a certain topic, it might get boring to us at some point, right? Preparing for class is relatively easy, for example, writing up lecture notes, but sometimes you're just not in the mood to do it. So I always try to make sure that I have time before I have to do it to make sure that I can always leave it aside if it's not what I feel like doing right now.
Did you do, say, like, we can't break up your academic career, say, like, undergrad, grad, postdoc, faculty? It sounded like you at least did multiple of these in different locations. Like, how difficult or easy was it for you to, like, kind of, you know, get up and move someplace, you know, every 3 or 4 years or however?
Yeah, for me, personally, it wasn't that difficult, but that's primarily, my dad was in the army when I was growing up, so we moved around a lot. I was born in Germany, actually. So, you know, we've lived there. I lived in Georgia, the state, not the country. And I've lived in Germany a second time. Probably the longest time I lived in one place before being an adult was in Maine, where I went to high school for 8 years. And so sort of getting up and moving every few years didn't feel that weird to me. And it was always very exciting. It was sort of a chance to have a fresh start every time. However, it did get to a point where I got sort of sick of it. So during my second postdoc, that was sort of the biggest year of lots of traveling, you know, between conferences and applying and interviewing for jobs. I was traveling a lot and I was at that point very sick of constantly moving around. And so it was probably around then that I decided that I was going to do a third postdoc for sure. And I had one all set up actually before I got this job. But I knew that was going to be the last one, that after that point I was sort of done moving around. And so for the first, you know, for a while, it was perfectly fine, and I enjoyed the always exploring new places. But yeah, I did get to that point, a certain age, if you will, that I was ready to just sort of settle down. And I've been here for 11 years. I'm just really happy to not have to, you know, move ever again. If at least in theory.
Are there like any challenges or like obstacles that you're comfortable sharing with, of like either your experiences doing research or, you know, just, you know, even academic, like professionalism going through kind of the academia career,
you know, it's
that stand out?
I mean, it's funny. I feel like I've had a very privileged time going through here. You know, I think that the only thing that in my life, well, besides any of my own personal failings, of which there are plenty, we'll just push those aside. I am gay, and so there's always been that notion of, oh, maybe I'll feel some sort of prejudice because of that. But Honestly, there's never been a moment in my life where that seems to have come up as an issue. And besides actually being gay, the thing about this is that I'm a white male. Therefore, from the outside, I'm sort of the typical physicist, right? And when people see me, they see, white male before they see anything else. So I feel as though I've actually never really had any serious obstacles beyond just having to at least prove that I'm capable of what I'm doing. But I do know plenty of people that, where that's not the case. And so I think I've just been sort of lucky. I think that my field has been fairly open to things like that, where they don't think of LGBT issues as a problem, if you will. So yeah, I don't think I've really had any serious obstacles in that sense.
Well, thank you for sharing. When you've done, like, I know at least in my experiences of different research things, at least when I was testing things out, like, oh, something went wrong, or I made this mistake, or I broke this tool or instrument like that, or anything's like maybe even like earlier on in your career of like, oh, these were maybe like little rookie mistakes or like learning experiences, if you will, in your early days of research.
Yeah, there are a lot of times when let me think here. I remember many, 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 many stupid things I've done throughout the years, but I don't remember them specifically. I just remember the stupidity I felt. There are definitely a lot of cases where I would do sort of a brute force approach, or I think actually probably my biggest flaw, and this is still today, I actually did this 2 hours ago, is just going too fast, right? That I'll just sort of say, okay, well, let's just get this running, and I won't even think about the parameters I'm putting in. I'll just let it run, and I won't even double check my equations, and I'll just sort of. And then I'll waste hours and hours and hours of time because it was all wrong. Probably the biggest thing was when I was that I still remember, and a friend of mine still laughs at me to this day, even though she was not a physicist, but she still finds it hilarious that I was running these simulations. I was doing some SU2 gauge theory simulations just on the gluon propagator. This was sort of my secondary project in grad school. And I was generating these lattices and running on the local computer cluster we had at WashU. And I spent 2 weeks running it all and got some results that just made no sense whatsoever. And I went to my advisor at the time and I was showing him all this stuff. And he said, oh, wait, are these the parameters you're using? Because they're completely wrong. And the idea was that I did not look at a paper that sort of said, oh, if you're using basically, if you use the time direction of the lattice in our field, if it's too small, can start to simulate finite temperature physics instead of zero temperature physics. And so basically, everything I did had nothing to do with what we were trying to do. And so that was sort of 3 weeks wasted. And a lot of computer time wasted. Luckily, it was local. It wasn't at a computer cluster or a supercomputer. Yeah, that's one of those things. I think a lot of them, those sorts of mistakes don't stick out to me too much, only because I think they happen so often that, and maybe that's me, or I'd like to think that this is normal for everybody, that you do stupid things all the time. And so you just have to embrace that stupidity and deal with the mistake you made and move on with it. So.
Yeah, when you get like, especially in like programming or something like that, how much of like, oh, you get a result that is maybe not what you're expecting, or like it didn't get, it doesn't make sense. Like, how much of that is like, oh, trying to figure out if your theory or background is like off, or like you just transposed to two somewhere, or something as trivial as that.
Yeah, it's basically all that. So Yeah, this is a constant problem. And this, I teach a computational physics class where it's so easy when you run a simulation of a program and you get a number and you're just, you're fairly confident that everything you did was right. And the yeah, there are cases where that happens just so often. Again, one of the calculations I'm working on right now, I'm cross-checking with two of my collaborators, and sometimes when I'm a little behind them, I feel kind of stupid because I'm the one sort of, well, looking at their results and then getting my own result. And if I disagree with them, then clearly something I did was wrong. And most of the time that's true. And every so often there was just a mistake that they both happened to make. And what's nice is that with the right people around, right, everyone's willing to say, oh, wait, I screwed up. I made a mistake. And I'd say that it's probably, I don't know if it's more often than not that there's just a mistake in the code or the theory is wrong, but usually a lot of the mistakes, by the time we get to the point where we're writing up the code, if there's something that is off about the result, I would say that it's most likely a problem with the code more than with the theory behind it. Now, the theory could still be wrong insofar as the number we get doesn't match up with what we expect. But usually on sort of the day-to-day checks that we like to do, those sorts of things, it's almost always a computer code issue. And specifically the calculations I'm doing right now, if the numbers don't work, then it's okay because what we're looking at are errors in our numbers. And so this is sort of telling us how to correct for our numbers because the simulations we do are in a finite volume, but we don't live in a finite volume. And so all of these calculations right now are just checking to see how large those errors are. And so
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, to me it just seems so easy. So there's so many opportunities to just like make a mistake somewhere. But yeah, I guess that's the importance of working in a group if you can at least cross check.
exactly.
So like your experience, like you've mentored students and you teach these classes and you've had your own experiences as a researcher. Like in your mind, what are in general like good skills or something that like if you want to be a physicist or go to grad school or even study physics as an undergrad, like what are kind of like the core skills or principles that you think someone should work on or focus on?
I think it's the idea of problem solving is sort of the easiest answer, and I sort of would generalize it more to critical thinking. This is one of the reasons I love being at a liberal arts college is that a lot of my students take a lot of humanities classes, and they all fit under the same umbrella of liberal arts, the sciences and the humanities, because they are essentially teaching the same skills, right? The knowledge you get in a history class versus a physics class is very, very different, but you still need to be able to look at something, whether or not it's a certain historical text in history or some sort of physics problem, and think about it critically and say, how do I solve this problem? And I think that the ability in physics specifically to generalize is definitely crucial. In fact, I think that probably the most useful, besides just taking physics courses and doing lots of problems and all that sort of standard stuff, I think that if a student doesn't have any sort of programming experience, even if they never go off and become a programmer or do any kind of numerical work later, learning how to program is probably the best non-physics tool to have because it requires you not just to try to figure out how to solve a problem, but you have to figure out how to rewrite the problem so that a computer understands it. And that's a perfect example of something where you're really delving into something in a deep way so that you're not just, oh, we're in chapter four of the textbook, so I know that this homework problem is going to relate to something in there. It's really more, I've got this problem I need to solve, and I I basically have to start from scratch. And that sort of that really allows you to delve into something in a very solid way that you don't get in a lot of undergraduate or even graduate physics classes a lot of times, because it's really all about just sort of throwing information at you to understand it. So I try to get all my students to do some sort of programming. And then the other nice thing about programming is it's the experimental physics for those of us who are really bad at experimental physics. Because, like you said, when you run a computer code and you run a program and you get a result, and your result is not what you expect, you have to try to figure out where that came from. And maybe there was some weird error in your code. Maybe something you started with was wrong. And you actually have to start digging into it and trying to decide, well, how wrong is my number if it is wrong? And why is it wrong? Does that make sense? And there's sort of a lot of experimental like physics in a computational physics class, for example, that can again allow you to delve into very complex ideas in a simple way.
Kind of to build off that a little bit and wrap things up here a little bit, is there like any other advice or tips of wisdom or anything like that that you would, pass on to people who are or students who are maybe thinking about becoming physicists?
I think the biggest thing, probably the best advice that's sort of not as standard, there's the standard advice of do lots of problems so you understand it or whatever. I think really in the end, you want to always do something you love. And barring that, do something that you like. And barring that, doing something that you're good at, right? We always talk about everyone looking for their passions and not everyone has a passion. But I think if you want to get into physics, I think that you have to be ready from day one and on day two and day three and day 4061 to just constantly feel stupid. No matter how smart you are, no matter how good you are at physics, you're going to make mistakes and you're going to feel like an idiot, right? There's a factor of two I lost or a negative sign. Sometimes they're really, really stupid mistakes we make. And instead of letting that get you down, I think the key there is to remember that those mistakes, those things that make you feel stupid, are going to stick with you and hopefully at least make you stop making those mistakes. And a lot of people that I've known, a lot of very smart professors that I've known throughout my time, were more than willing to defer to a graduate student, even an undergraduate, when they realize that they made a mistake, because none of us are perfect. And so I think that just not letting that stupidity hold you back, it should propel you forward.
Very nice. I love that advice. So we talked a lot about physics here and, life as a physicist or your journey there. What are like some hobbies or interests that you have, outside of physics? I imagine you're not always in the lab 24/7.
Yeah, no, I would go insane. So let's see, my probably the there's sort of I'm of course a big science fiction nerd. Star Trek is the greatest franchise of all time for sure. So basically anything science fiction related, I'm ready to watch or read. In terms of things that I like to do, my husband and I are huge board gamers. And by board games, I don't mean Monopoly, of course. But there's a whole realm of designer board games out there, super heavy games that so every weekend is filled with those in our lives. And of course, then there's the obsession of my dogs. I've always loved dogs. I've grown up with dogs, and so yeah, we've got our two rescue dogs. We always rescue our dogs. Always, always, always. So we have our nice little 10-year-old Chihuahua mix and our 2-year-old, like I guess he's a pit bull mix. He's a really weird, bizarre mutt of a dog. And so if it's not playing board games or watching science fiction stuff, it's just being home with the dogs, which of course this last year has been kind of great. So
Very nice. What's like your top board game that you're into?
Oh, that's a tough one. There's so many good ones. Some of my favorites, there's one called Agricola, which is basically you're a farmer and it's a very, very heavy game. You don't even get many actions during it, but you're just trying to build up your farm and improve your little house. And that's definitely up there in terms of it's the kind of game the first time you play it, it's awful and horrible because it's that difficult at first. But after a while, it's a super deep game that has a lot going on with it. There's another one that I really love called Through the Ages that it's basically a card game where you're building a civilization. And again, it sounds really stupid. It sounds kind of lame where you're just sort of buying cards and playing them. And but there, again, there's this depth to it that's always fun to find in these kind sorts of games.
Oh, very nice. Sounds like a fun time. Are these is it typically like you and your husband that play these games, or is there like a group or a community that you are a part of?
It's primarily us. We're fairly antisocial. So it's basically any game that we play has to accommodate two players well. But every so often we do actually now have some former students of mine actually. They graduated like 5 or 6 years ago. They've started coming over every month or so, and so we'll have sort of a larger gaming group. We always talk about joining groups in the area. I mean, New York City is huge. There are lots of these sorts of groups around. And then we just realized that we'd rather stay at home because we're kind of homebodies. But so yeah, so I'd say most of the time it's that. And we have a couple other friends that every so often come over to play games, but usually it's just mostly two-player games. Yeah.
All right, fun. Well, thank you for coming on and doing this. It was really fun, talking with you and learning about all the stuff that you do and, everything about you. Thank you.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. You're welcome.